Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
That's right. That's a statement of fact, and I defy you to say otherwise. I'm not sensitive, Your Honor.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, everybody. It's me, Justin.
Now, gentlemen, we have a special guest today. I've been very fortunate to be asked by Kevin J. Anderson of Wordfire Press to participate in a humble bundle along with some amazing authors, including, if you look up the Humble Bundle, get a humblebundle.com, you'll see some great books. And down there in like that really, that power section, like the really, really, like I'm like the free chafe you give away for one penny. But down there, you'll see a book called Decision Points. And that's a collection of, it's interesting short stories about people making critical decisions effectively, but somebody could explain it better would be one of the authors there, Jody Lynn Nye.
Yay, Jody.
Welcome, Jody.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Jody, on your webpage explains that you are you spend most of your time spoiling cats.
Oh, yes. Yeah, at the moment, just one cat in chief. But, of course, any cat can be spoiled if I happen to come across it.
So and, there is a preoccupation between writers and cats.
There really does seem to be. I do know a lot of fervent dog people also, and, well, you know, we understand.
Yeah, we're in agreement on that. Mm-hmm. So, Jody, the way this works here is we talk about weird stuff
Okay. Sometimes,
or sometimes we talk about future stuff or exciting stuff. And we have gotten a reputation as the bit of an Elon Musk fan club, and that's going to only persist because Friday, we're recording this Sunday, 2 days ago, SpaceX achieved a major milestone in rocket reusability. And that was they landed successfully the Falcon 9 on top of a barge way out at sea.
It landed on the platform. It actually stuck the landing this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the footage is available. There's 4K footage on YouTube on the SpaceX channel, and it is stunning. I'm certain that we'll get some, you know, edited version from all the different camera angles. But again, man, the gonads to allow their failures for a publicly traded company to allow their failures.
Well, they're not publicly traded.
Oh wait. Oh no. Okay. Sorry.
I'm thinking of Tesla. Privately owned.
But to allow all their mistakes to be right there in public to have this moment, though, is when it really pays off, when it's like they got it right, they nailed it, and if I read correctly, and I'm sure you've dived into these numbers more than I have, immediately, once they start recovering craft, they get like a 30% decrease in their costs, which I assume... what was the difference? It's $60 million to make one of these craft. Mm-hmm. It's $200,000 to fuel them.
Around that, yeah.
Yeah. So and replace all the bits that need to be replaced, like gaskets and so on, for safety's sake.
Jody, as a science fiction fantasy writer, how do rapid developments like this affect when you're sitting down to write something, or does it even come into view?
Oh, well, it means that we have to jump just a little bit far ahead. We've done what we can to extrapolate based on the facts that we have. And every time something real happens, we have to rejigger whatever it was we were doing, such as in the 1950s, Isaac Asimov wrote these young adult books, and one of them involved people walking around on Jupiter. And it wasn't that many years later when they found out that it was a gas giant and you can't walk around on it. So... he's published it with a disclaimer in the foreword saying, okay, this is what we knew then. Here's what we know now.
There's a part of me that finds it extra charming, though, to find depictions of celestial objects that, you know, that we know different now. Like there was some Ray Bradbury story about somebody going insane, walking in the constantly raining jungle forests of Venus the entire time.
I remember that story. Yeah. It's hot rain for forever.
Right, exactly. I don't know. I find that kind of endearing and charming. But it seems to me that there's kind of a double-edged sword, right? So let's say you find out that Jupiter is now a gas giant. You know for sure that you're not going to be writing stories about walking around on Jupiter. But on the flip side, you don't want to be like, okay, it looks like reusable rockets are going to work. Therefore, I'm just going to write reusable rockets as the way everyone gets around, because 100 years from now, we might have something even more efficient.
Yeah, I think that's a, Brian, I think that's a good point. Is that you, it's a good idea what the near term is for the next, you know, 20 or 30 years. But when we're trying to figure out much further out, and you see that a lot in older science fiction where people writing stuff in the 50s and things changed a lot, but they're still, you know, using technology. You would think like, man, I don't see how anybody could think this would still be around, you know?
Well, it's a big deal when for example, data storage. Mm-hmm. You read Heinlein, for example, and things were on tape, and that was the cutting edge. And no one could picture anything further than that. And now we have thumb drives and crystal storage. And I just read a wonderful article that more or less fits into the weird stuff, is they're trying to figure out a way to program it into DNA so that you have permanent storage for petabytes, all the way up to, I guess, nanobytes.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to keep guessing as best we can what, or make something so weird sounding that it will never be wrong because no one's ever going to
because it's nonsense. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. Or by the time it sound plausible.
Yeah, but by the time people notice that it's wrong, it doesn't matter. You know, it's, I just reread H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, and you know, for a book that was written in like 1894, 1896 or something, it was amazing how much he got right and how much I don't know what an alien invasion will look like, but just his trying to make something kind of, I would say it's not any less scientifically accurate about many movies that come out today when he's trying to figure out how would these aliens adapt to our environment, the idea that would they be radically different, and you know, getting away from like 50 or 60 years earlier when people were trying to imagine people living on heavenly bodies, they were just, you know, looked like us, or there it was more of a religious connotation than a scientific one.
So I think what's interesting from a creative perspective in terms of writing is kind of the other side of this, that instead of trying to say, okay, well, now there's this rapid advancement, how do we throw the ball further in a fictional story? There seems to be now more that you can tell if you want to do a near future science fiction story. I know, Andrew, that was a huge theme in Station Breaker, but I'm curious to hear Jody's thoughts on, you know, what does this kind of fertile scientific landscape do for near-term science fiction and fantasy stories?
I think it's a terrific opportunity, especially when you have so much information. Elon Musk has been very forthcoming about the problems that they've had with SpaceX and the landing, and it gives us terrific information because most stories don't just begin with what if. They go on to what if something went terribly wrong.
Yeah.
So you take that idea, you run with it, you read up as much as you can, and it will give you the idea of where to tweak that, where that story opportunity lies. I wrote a story for an anthology called Launchpad that benefits the Launchpad Astronomy Seminar for Writers and Artists. And I was working with state-of-the-art breaking information at the time that was talking about how spectra analysis not only tells us where exoplanets are, but what their possible makeup is and what their atmosphere looks like. And extrapolating just a little bit farther, Mike Brotherton, who was my co-editor on that, wrote a story in which he could see whether or not there were life signs on the planets based upon what was the cutting edge, what was happening right now.
Well, and I think that's a really good point in that you're focused on the trends, not the actual data points that we have. Like, obviously, right now we have a data point that shows that a reusable rocket is theoretically possible. But the trend essentially says that getting to space is going to get so cheap that it becomes essentially free, which is, there's a fantastic book by Peter Diamandis, Bold, where he talks about if you're going to build a new business venture, go ahead and yes, we're not there now, but go ahead and assume that computing power is cheap, ubiquitous, and essentially free. Assume that storage is essentially free. Assume that transport is becoming almost free. And so the idea that we're kind of getting to that point, even with something as outrageous as space travel, is utterly inspiring. I mean, to think that right now people are coming up with business plans that, no, we can't do them today, probably can't do them 20 years from now, but they will be eminently viable in just 40 or 50 years.
Well, I wouldn't say that it would be free any more than air travel has become free.
But again, it certainly is trending in that direction. It gets cheaper and cheaper, as inflation renders the dollar worth less and less. You can more people making at the average salary, it's become cheaper year after year after year. For example, when I started touring all over the United States, it was a strange time in that it was shortly after 9/11. So all of a sudden, pretty much a business plan that made no sense, that every morning I would wake up in Austin, Texas, and then that evening do a show somewhere in the United States. But it was just, I was able to take 200 pounds of magic gear and ride a mostly empty plane by myself. That's the kind of outrageous, out-of-the-box thinking that starts to happen when you follow the trend lines.
Certainly. As these costs drop, and obviously never quite to the point that it's as free as Jody points out, but like you point, it's you can build business models on top of that where it was really hard to do that with one launch capability, big launch capability with a shuttle and, the Russians in a very limited opportunity to try to figure out the economics of that. And now you see that. And you know where I saw some of this excitement last night?
Where is that?
Oh, when I went to a dance party underneath the space shuttle.
What?
Well, I got to ask.
What kind of shenanigans did you get into, man?
What did you guys do to celebrate Yuri's night just out of curiosity?
Oh, man. I'm looking at Andrew Main looking badass in his leather jacket, hanging out in what's clearly a rave just in a hangar.
A perfect selfie, well lit. Yes, it's Yuri's night.
And good composition.
Oh, what a night.
So that's the Space Shuttle Endeavor, which is on permanent exhibit at the California Science Center and at the Samuel Ocean Pavilion. And what they did, it was a party last night. So Yuri's night, which is a celebration every year of Yuri Gagarin, the first man into space, mm-hmm. who back in 1961, first brave soul who made it up there, it passed the Kármán line. And, it is, a worldwide celebration of this achievement of what he did. And I've been to like one of them before in Orlando, and this was the first one. I went to one out here, and I would best describe it as you would see people dressed up in costumes. You'd see that you'd expect to see people in Star Trek costumes. You see people in Star Wars costumes. There was a husband and wife walking around dressed as the drone ships that caught Falcon 9.
Oh, that's adorable. Please read the instructions.
So, wow.
I would best describe it as, if you know what the white party is, it's the white party for nerds. It is
That's
fabulous. It was fun. It was just you're in the big hangar underneath the space shuttle with, it's a bunch of space enthusiasts, I guess, way to describe it. So that was a really, really cool thing to go to.
That is fantastic. Some years ago, I stood on Cocoa Beach and saw Endeavor launch, and that was an incredibly moving moment. My friends were in from Great Britain, and we had gone around Florida, gone to Disney World, gone to see all sorts of sites, and we got to watch the shuttle launch. And they cried. Actually, I cried too, but it was as moving for them as it was for us. And just an astonishing moment, because the space program means something to everybody. It's aspiration. And for the people who keep saying, no, we've got to concentrate all our efforts on Earth, they're missing the point of what I think humankind really wants is aspiration. We want something that's so far outside of ourselves that we have to do all kinds of preparation. We have to think. We have to give our best efforts to it.
Yeah, that certainly gets into a subjective choice. I mean, I'm wearing my Light Sail Project T-shirt, and I'm for that. But I do understand in a world of increasing resources, but not infinite resources, right, where people might have different, there's an exhibit there they have where they have like put a token in there for how much of the budget you think NASA should get or not get or whatever, which is interesting because it's what he says. Like, I'm a person like, well, is there a way for me to vote on how I think they should be more intelligently appropriating their money, towards the things that I like, but that's neither here nor there.
And when you look at the actual budget of NASA, in terms of the proportion of what it gets out of the national budget, it's tiny.
Well, compared to what? What the Europeans spend? What any other nation spends?
No, compared to the budget itself.
I know, but we spend five times more than any other nation as a part of our budget. We spend more collectively than the rest of the world does on space exploration. And you know, I don't know that how much of our budget we spend on our rather inflated national budget is a metric for how we should judge how much we care about it. When we look at, I love NASA, but when you look at how many billions of dollars are committing to a program like the SLS program, which could be far better directed, get rid of that program and take half of what that is and spend it better within there. And we have
spending
far
it better. I would love to see them spending it better. Part of what happens with any part of the budget is politics.
Right.
Yes, you have to have this base in this state because this senator has been fighting for it for 60 years, so it has to be here. And in spite of the fact that it would be better served elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree. And that's
and
the problem.
So
it's like that. Why we get problems like the SLS is because it rewards contract. And I guess that's my frustration. It's the thing is that, like, NASA did an internal study to try to find out, you know, what would have cost for them to have built, you know, their own Falcon 9 rocket like SpaceX had. And, it turned out that it would cost at least 2 to 3 times as much and probably would have taken 2 to 3 times as long, mm-hmm. which shows you there's, you know, if we can, then that's why so many of them are excited about the idea of just having companies go out there and develop the technology, then be able to hire it out like FedEx, which is.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that there is definitely a place in it for private industry. It's helping a lot.
I totally thought that you were going to say, Andrew, NASA did an internal survey on how much it would cost to make a Falcon 9. And as it turns out, they're still counting to this day.
Yes.
They're using one of those adding machines that has a handle on the side.
Yeah, yes. No, it's just the national debt clock. It's just like a constant upward trend.
Yeah, and there is some amazing stuff going on. You look at the Dawn series, you know, right now we have a spacecraft the size of a truck orbiting the asteroid minor, we call it a dwarf planet, pretty much, Ceres. We're going to be getting some great Jupiter data back in July. There's some fantastic, fantastic stuff. And that's my thing. It's like, man, there's a lot of great other little missions in there that are just suffering that could get more stuff. But
and Cassini is finding such astonishing things. And I've been told that people are allowed to send projects up on the shuttles or on the satellites for their own scientific research. You know, you pay, you send up a box of a certain size, and you can have an experiment go up. I think that's marvelous.
Yeah, we talked to what was that company that we talked about that sold those slots for super cheap?
There's like NanoRacks, or there's some other ones. There's a few different companies that will let you do that, and there's also. There's a thing called CubeSats, which are the small ones. There's something
that's
called
what
CubeSats.
It was, the
CubeSats.
That's CubeSats.
There's another one where you can do like little, almost like glow stick size things that if you want to go do something up there. So there's a lot of really cool things that are opening up as we increase stuff. There's a plan to put a new launcher onto the ISS to make it easier to put things into orbit from there, but still, you know, getting it there. So yeah, there's a lot of, it's exciting. So
this is a totally, it's a rude thought to have, and I couldn't help myself, and I can't be the only one who have that thought. Yes, it is truly a monumental achievement that they landed the first stage of a rocket on the barge that's going to have tremendous potential. How long do you think we are from sending one of those back up? How many years out from actually seeing?
Well, certainly that's the next target, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're now, Elon
that's,
Musk.
That's got to be the next milestone, really.
Yeah, Elon Musk says May or July, Brian.
What? This same guy? Oh, man, that's great.
How many years? Brian.
Welcome to the 21st century, dude.
Yeah, well, I figured the first one would be, you know, pretty much dissected to test for, I guess you could test without destroying it, but I mean, you would want to find out, you know, what kind of micro fractures you're dealing with and all that stuff.
The plan is
they're going to be scanned like mad, but the whole point is to be able to send the same one back up.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure. I just wouldn't have thought that the very first one that landed. Well, I guess it's the second one because we had the one that landed on land.
The first one is going into the museum, as he says. Right. So, yeah, I think he said something like July or August. But like this, he ideally they want to get like 10 bursts, you know, test firings on it and see that. Right. And then flip that thing around. And that's the plan.
That's so awesome. Within the next year, the goal is to launch one within days of recovery is what Marobot says in the chat. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
I'd love that. That would
What's the goal past that? Like, I feel like we're blowing past these kind of like gigantically significant milestones that there almost feels like there's not a fatigue, but certainly a numbing of like, oh, wow, we've just got speed on this, the likes of which we haven't seen in years and years and years. But once it goes back up, like, is that just the final announcement that the future's here?
Well, no, I guess at that point, it's a matter of just scaling up, right? Getting it to where there's launches three times a week.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, supply actually meets demand, which
Now we're going to talk about expansion. At that point, it's just not the ISS. It's what's the goal? Where is SpaceX going from here? Mm-hmm. To one point, because that is a multi-government installation, but for building other structures in space, going back to the moon, and Elon Musk wants to go to Mars.
Part of the payload on this Dragon mission, by the way, which the spacecraft is connected to the ISS right now, is a Bigelow Aerospace expandable space habitat. They're going to expand to see how, you know, it's one of these, it's designed to sort of call it inflatable, probably, maybe they don't like it, I don't know. But anyhow, it's an inflatable habitat that gets larger that can house people. And that's a big step, because as you start making access to space cheaper, as Jody points out, right now we got ISS, which is a multi-nation effort, but then you could start getting into private companies launching their own space, you know, stations, or have multiple stations, other governments have them, or other, you know, more importantly, scientific agencies doing that.
Yeah, is that okay? So how long until we start seeing the backlash of the idea of just any old schmo getting to go up to space? Because we already have the detail. You know, right now we don't really worry about somebody going up to space and tearing stuff up, unless it's a government, you know, like, you know, China blew up a satellite or whatever. But once it becomes cheap enough, anyone can do it, or heaven forbid, somebody launches the world's first Trojan horse, a satellite that acts like it's supposed to measure, you know, gamma waves, but instead all of a sudden fires off a rocket and smashes into sabotage some other satellite. How long until we're looking at space espionage?
Who says we haven't already?
I mean, that's true. We have
spy sats. Another thing Mike Brotherton said is we're up at the WIRO, the Wyoming Infrared Observatory, and he said, okay, with the infrared goggles on that he lent us, he said, you can probably, not only can you see the Andromeda Galaxy, by the way, which was exceptionally cool, but you can see satellites going by. And he said, the ones that are going east to west are the ordinary satellites. The ones going north to south are spy sats. So, yeah, we're already doing it. We're already seeing it.
Wake up, sheeple.
Yeah, it's happening fast. I'm going to change tact here. And, you know, I don't really have any weird news unless, I don't know, a story about Bigfoot, Hillary Clinton, and a cryptid phallic symbol.
Wait, didn't that make the news recently? One of Hillary Clinton's advisors said that if she's elected president, they would like to, you know, he would personally, or she has indicated that she was open to the idea of declassifying a bunch of UFO stuff.
There's nothing to do with that.
I know, but I forgot that happened just this week as well. And then when asked personally if he believed in UFOs, he gave a coy, oh, I just think there's an awful lot of planets out there. There's an awful lot of space. That is not a vector I anticipated in the 2016 election cycle.
All politics is local.
This particular election cycle has been full of weirdness beyond anything that I've ever seen.
If I may continue, I have some weirdness for you that will even take it further.
Please proceed.
There's a freedom of speech issue going on over in Andover because somebody had what looked like a silhouette statue of Bigfoot. And then somebody, the owner of said Bigfoot statue, decided to make a political comment on our former Secretary of State, currently running for President of the United States, with a Hillary Clinton sign in front of said Bigfoot statue. And then Bigfoot statue is pointing to the statue, not with his hands or arms. Okay, or pointing to the sign, rather. They're pointing to the sign, the Clinton sign, and then there's a big Trump sign in front of there, apparently. And then somebody decided they were not happy with this, so they went and removed the Bigfoot's pointing anatomy from there. And so now there's a big of a freedom of speech question over that, and, you know.
Well, this is, I thought we couldn't descend any further into crudity in this election cycle.
No.
This is certainly an election issue. You know, Maryland is a primary state that has yet to vote. It is important on both sides of the aisle for their primaries. So this is finally an issue that can cut through all the clutter and really focus on what matters in America.
Yeah, real quick, how is this a free speech issue? Like, is this private property, public property?
Private property. The argument from the person who removed said, pointing anatomy,
object,
said that this was obscene and that it was, but obviously there's a process which you go through. You're not allowed to actually do vigilantism to remove said things.
Right.
People do protests on private property all the time. A couple of friends of mine came in to see their son at Great Lakes Naval Base. He was the boy was about to graduate, and his dad came in and on purpose rented a banana yellow Hummer so that he could make his son mortified by driving up to pick him up. Well, overnight on our driveway, and I live on a dead end street, somebody came by and egged it.
Wow.
Here's your protest on private property. And they egged our house in the process, which was just thrilling.
Kids these days.
Yeah, there is other Yeti news. Apparently Vladimir Putin, this is Siberian Times, one of the most reputable news sources we use here. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Putin cites a Yeti family in remote Siberian mountains.
I mean, so is the game in Russia just to treat Vladimir Putin the way the internet treated this was published on the 1st of April, 2016.
Oh, it's totally joking.
Oh, okay.
thank you, Brian.
But
next topic.
But my question is, hold on. But like the whole thing, like, I mean, Putin's just Russia's Chuck Norris, right? Back when we thought it was hilarious to attribute, you know, make Chuck Norris into Paul Bunyan. Like, is that what they do in Russia? Do you know?
That's what he encourages.
Yeah. Hey, now's a good time for us to take a moment to remind the folks that keep weird things happening on a weekly basis. If you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can join the ranks of the proud 438 fantastic patrons keeping us loud, live, and independent. We cannot thank you guys enough, and we want to continue to bring you the important news that matters about Yetis and political figures.
And while you're on the internet, check out the Humble Bundle, which helps benefit the Challenger Space Science Center, which is a initiative to help educate young kids about space science, and the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Emergency Fund. So two very good causes which are benefited from the Humble Bundle, of which Jody and I are proud to be participants in. Mm-hmm. And you can select down there how much money you want to go towards those causes and how much you want to go towards Humble Bundle or us or WordFire, and then trickle down. But all good. Like I said, while you're on the internet, you know, supporting weird things, you know, support space science and authors.
Absolutely. No, I mean, this is we know for sure that there are a lot of voracious readers that listen to this show. And I think that would be money well spent.
Hey, real quick, I don't think we got the specific details on what's in this Humble Bundle. How many titles and what the suggested prices are?
It's 18 books. And it's a terrific value. It's all sorts of people who are bestsellers. And for $15, that's the minimum to get all three tiers. It's less than three lattes. You'll have books to read for most of the summer if you pick this up. It's got an absolutely fantastic lineup. There are steampunk and contemporary thriller and traditional science fiction, young adult, some very funny contemporary fantasy. Josh Vogt, a fellow that I know, did a book called Enter the Janitor. And appearing for the very first time in this bundle is the sequel to it, which is called The Maids of Wrath.
Yeah.
And the anthology that I'm in, which is called Decision Points, is young adult, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Stories for really enjoyable stories, a whole lot of things. Some things that Frank Herbert wrote that have never before been published, really wow. Exciting stuff. And anthologies, short stories, novels, a really great collection. And for a mere $15, which is impulse buy for most people, you can have 18 books.
Yeah, it's actually 22 books because two of those books, like Frank Herbert, is four.
Yeah, that's right. That's for novellas.
I'll give you both of my chronological mans is bundled as one. So it's a
Yeah,
and such a bargain.
These are all delivered.
I'm not great at math, but that's like a little bit more than a buck a book.
$15 or $15 divided by 22 bucks.
I'm just Josh.
I was there with you. I was there for you, Justin. So these are all delivered in what kind of format? On all types?
They are e-format. You can get them in Mobi or EPUB. I don't believe that they're in PDF or anything else.
I had to upload a PDF.
Yeah, it says here they come in PDF, EPUB, and Mobi formats. Yep. Yeah.
These work on your Kindle, your iPad, Kobos, and Nooks.
Yeah, and DRM free, man. Put them where you want. Like, they ain't going to be like, hey, not with that, sir. They're like, any which way you want it.
They are there for you forever. And it's an instant gratification.
Dude, and how long is it available? How fast? How urgent is it to move on this?
Should move now. It ends in 9 days.
Okay, no, but that's good. So, like, if you're listening to it midweek, it's not too late. So do us a favor and hop on this right away. Still,
go.
9 days, 20 hours, 6 minutes.
And do we have a easy link for it, or?
humblebundle.com/books/wordfire-press-science-fiction.
So go to Humble Bundle and click on Book Bundles.
It's the one that comes up.
Yeah.
And humblebundle.com/books will work just as well this week while it's active.
Gentlemen, Jody, we have a all right. Do we want to go weird? Do we want to go historical? Do we want to go science-y?
Historical sounds intriguing. We don't get those very often.
Historical. Have you heard there is plans afoot, and it's actually some research. They think they've been able to track the path that the Carthaginian general Hannibal did when he led an army of 30,000 men through the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have, did you hear how they may have identified the route he took?
By satellite, I presume.
This is a different way in which they may have used satellites to figure out where to look, but then they found some very interesting evidence that helped them find it. On the ground.
A few minutes.
Would you move that many animals and a lot of and 37 elephants?
That's what I figured.
Yes, they've actually using radiocarbon dating, microbial metagenome analysis, environmental chemistry, and pollen analysis. They have shown that a mass animal depositing event occurred near this site in 218 BC. And so basically they're like, man, there's a lot of dung here. What could have gone on here? And they called all the local circuses, no response.
Ha.
And looks like they found the trail based upon poo.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I mean, you got to figure like these, you know, any kind of great, especially like empire building migration was not done with a light footprint, right? Like, you know, there's got to be a million different ways like this to
And so what they're able to do is they're able to pick up the microbes that were particular, let's say, you know, flourished in horse dung and other sorts of, you know, like the animals that would be there. And it was very different from other areas. And microbial archaeology now is a whole other area of science. And if you take a look at, there are a lot of these ancient cities and places which we know very, very little about. But if you're able to go in there and do, but some of these microbes will stay for a long time. You can have an idea of where they traded from, where they came in from, where people were moving. So that is an idea that radically, you know, new to me as far as, you know, this, the whole concept of that aspect of microbial archaeology.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's such a tragedy that that so much of our story, the story of ourselves, is lost to prehistory. And it's wonderful to get moments of these where the evidence comes in and it's very clear that, you know, let's say with 100% certainty, they now know that this is the path they took. And that's great that we're getting more fidelity. But there's always going to be that frontier, that looking back just a little bit farther that we wish we could do to know more about ourselves. I mean, keep in mind, I'm thrilled. In my lifetime, we found out that, you know, a lot of us are part Neanderthal and had relatives that were doing it with Neanderthals. I'm thrilled that we're trending in the right direction, but we'll never get enough for my tastes.
No, we never will. We have the Field Museum in Chicago here, And I am always delighted to go through the various places where they have the fossil records and the dioramas of ancient humans. And there's a place where you can put your foot into the footprint of ancient humans. Actually hominids. And it's just tantalizing that there's so much and yet there's so little.
Yeah.
What's exciting, though, is the fact that, you know, in the last 30, 40 years, we've seen all the advances we've been made with DNA. The fact that we know that we're part Neanderthal because we could actually look at the Neanderthal genome, which mm-hmm. is an area that we didn't expect we'd be able to have. The satellites have, as Jody pointed out earlier, satellites have been showing us where ancient cities were, ancient trade routes, all these other things we didn't realize. Now with microbial stuff, there's a lot of things you can do with gut bacteria and the gut biome, as far as tracing back where people came from and some things. Then the idea of just the soil itself and finding out. And your point, Brian, yeah, we're never going to know it as much as we want to know, but our ability to know just increased several magnitudes beyond what we thought 50 years ago. We thought there were unknowables.
And all of those examples are just in our increased understanding and our ability to collect the remnants of that stuff. Imagine what happens as over the next 50 years, artificially intelligent programs begin to run simulations that, mm-hmm. that predict with a high degree of accuracy, like the only way we could end up right here is if it looked like this a while back. It's going to be tremendous, and it's wonderful to get more of those answers.
Absolutely. That's a very exciting thing. I would love to see Google do some initiative like that, where you could start plugging in bits of data. Like, we know there was a city here 3,000 years ago, and the computer would use some AI to say, well, they had to have a dump, they had to have water, they had to have these things, and based on the topography, go look here. And that's going to be information archaeology combined with adding these sort of details in there will help us build a very, very interesting picture. And it's Bayesian in the sense that you can add these details in and make a much more accurate picture. I look forward to that.
Did you ever watch Time Team? Wonderful program. It came from Great Britain.
I watched the one on Doggerland.
Okay. I didn't see that one. But they are given the ability to search in an archaeological site for about a week. That's all they get. But mm-hmm. they have been able to uncover some incredibly interesting sites and facets of a site that people never dreamed existed, or that they were surprised at how extensive that they were. And thanks to satellite technology and the ground-based radar that they use to go around the sites, they've picked up where walls were. Even walls made of wood still leave traces. Mm-hmm. And they find artifacts, wonderful things. But satellite technology has helped so much with this because they are finding sites that have been completely forgotten. Like I was told that quite a lot of the Mayan sites in Mexico were completely hidden by jungle. And yet, going over them with satellite technology using radar, they're pinpointing places where they should search.
That's incredible. Tremendous.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff.
If you have a chance, they did the special Doggerland, which is the area between UK and Europe, which is now below the water, but about 6,000-7,000 years ago before the ice caps put us mm-hmm. into an interglacial, was above the sea level and was maybe one of the most verdant and inhabitable places in all of Europe.
Yeah, because it was bottomland. What they call bottomland, which means that it would have gotten the best of the irrigation before it got too much irrigation.
Yeah, until it got too silty and all that. But so they Time Team did a special on that called Britain's Drowned World, which is really worth checking out too. And trying to piece together, you would think would be a totally, totally almost lost to history, but not quite. Jody, this is the point of the show where we do picks, where we pick something we've read or something we watched and something we want to recommend to everybody out there.
Okay. I wanted to bring up something that was weird I come from Illinois, and we have a state fossil, and it's called the Tully Monster. And I'm sending an article to Bryce right now for that. And it's an extremely weird-looking thing. And for many years, the scientists who discovered it thought that it was an invertebrate. But now they've decided that it is, in fact, a vertebrate creature. And what it looks like is pretty much like a Muppet. It looks like a bag with a sort of crane on the front of it. It's there. You go.
Okay. If a single crab claw just detached itself and swam away from the crab And then that's what this looks like. That's extraordinary.
Now, the thing in the back there, across the back, is a bar with an eye on each end. No, not up there. Across the back of the Tully Monster. That's its eyes. God.
So it's got so picture I don't know, like pleosaurus, is that what we thought
it
Nessie was?
It almost looks like a pleosaur, except that it's the long protuberance in the front is not only its sort of nose, but its teeth and throat.
Yeah.
How do we spell this?
Tully. It's named after the fellow who discovered it, the Tully Monster.
Well, so picture fossil. A plesiosaur, but its back is holding a pool cue, and right. On the end of each side of the pool cue is a ping pong ball on each side, and that's its eyes coming out from the middle of the arch of its back. That's some innovative design work, I guess.
Well, clearly it didn't survive, so it wasn't that good a design. It is unique to Illinois. It's never been seen anywhere else.
I did a search for Tully Monster, and I found a Muppet.
I wouldn't be surprised. My cousin does paleontological dentistry. He's a dentist by trade, but he also works with the Field Museum, and he worked on Sue, the Tyrannosaurus that is there.
Wow.
And he said she had a massive abscess in her jaw of size of a pool ball, really. It's probably one of the things that killed her was that she was probably in terrible pain. And but I had no idea that such a cool hobby existed.
That's funny. Yeah. I have a funny story.
He does. He goes down to the museum and examines the teeth.
What was that?
There was Chicago, I think they anonymously bid on Sue because they didn't want to create a bidding war over it. And they outbid a philanthropist who was actually trying to buy it to donate to them.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yes.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
That'll teach him.
Yeah. He ended up getting like the second, the copy they made of it. It's like the second, like they made, they produced like a second one. But that,
right. The head that's on the skeleton that's on display in the lobby is actually a reproduction. The actual skull is upstairs because it's just too heavy for the framework. Yeah. You can see it right there, but they did some amazing work. Putting it back together again. The skull is 5 feet long.
Wow. Wow. All right. Well, hey, I got a pick here real quick. I went to see a show. I saw a friend, a cohort of ours, and was blown away by his stage show. He had an awesome packed auditorium at the Bass Concert Hall, and it was an astonishing economy in that he held 2,600 people spellbound, riveted, using nothing but stuff in a single paper bag. There's a paper bag when it starts, and he held everyone spellbound. Talented, charming, funny, incredible. Michael Carbonaro, if you haven't seen his show, The Carbonaro Effect on True TV, a gentleman and a scholar, and the kids loved it, and I loved it. And he's good, good people, and it was good to get to see him.
Go to his website because you can see his live tour as he's working his way around the country. And I've heard nothing but fantastic things about the show right now. Ran into the Magic Castle last week. We're supposed to get together when between his run on this. But
it's so many good memories because, of course, there is that week that we all performed together at the Magic Castle during the Magic versus Science tour.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'll tell you. I had the pleasure of seeing him perform non-magic, do the Telltale Heart at an event in the Brookledge Mansion. And he's an amazing actor, It was the girl I brought with me would not shut up about how great it was. You know, I was great, but she's like, that's like the favorite thing I've seen all year. You know, and so when I talked to Michael, I'm like, you know, like, your magic's good, but like my friend, she will not stop about that. You know, so he's a guy who is a very, very gifted performer, and you know, obviously does the show The Carbonaro Effect, which you can see, which they're doing. I think they just started season 4 on that, and now he's finding somehow the time to go on the road and go do a show. So
busy guy. Yep. Very, very talented, always one of the one of the good ones.
Yep.
I got a pick. Sorry, Andrew, were you gonna go?
No, please.
Saw a movie on Friday. It's called Midnight Special. It's directed by Jeff Nichols. I had not seen his other two movies, which were very highly critically regarded, Mud and Take Shelter. This is a really, really, really fun movie. Like, it's it is almost like a B movies plot, you know, that is told about as artfully as you you possibly could. You know, got great performances by Michael Shannon, Joel Edgerton, Kirsten Dunst, and Adam Driver is has a supporting role that's very clever and fun. But you know, the less you kind of know about it, I think, you know, the more you'll be sucked into it. It's not an especially complex plot involving a kid that has undefined powers and all the adventures that happen as, you know, it's a very small story of a few people trying to, you know, ferry this kid from here to there and all the complications around it. But super fun. I liked it a lot. And it's one of those movies where, you know, you look at that director and you're like, man, in the right hands, he could be handed the reins of a huge franchise and just do one of like the biggest movies ever. Like he definitely, this I think is his test run through sci-fi, fantasy, special effects stuff, and everything comes off really well. So very much dug it. Midnight Special.
Awesome. Jody, do you have anything, or your Telly Monster, or...
Well, yeah, I've got a lot of things I can suggest. One of them is a sort of steampunk detective series that's been running for, I think, 9 years in Canada called, it's called The Murdoch Mysteries Up There, but it's being syndicated here in the United States as The Artful Detective. And I really don't see how that has a connection to the plot itself. But it's a really well-written, well-acted series, and just finding it to be fascinating. Yep, that's it.
Yeah, they had, I think the first season was on Netflix for a while. Is it still there?
Yeah, I think they're in like season 9. They're doing terrific stuff.
Okay.
My husband's
we'll
a huge fan.
Find out if that's on Netflix or not.
He said, you need to sit down and watch this. And since he's the one who sat me down and made me watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure when I do not want to watch a movie about a couple of California slackers, but he was right. And he was right about this too. This is a good series.
Justin, I won't take too much offense about that.
Yeah.
My pick.
Well, they turned out to be two of the best good guys in the world. I mean, that's the terrific thing about the Bill and Ted's. But the Murdoch Mysteries are really interesting. They do period stuff very well, but they also introduce characters of the day like Nikola Tesla and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Also, San Dimas football rules.
Yes,
computers.
Yeah, just trying to see what was available. Yeah, they was. I guess it's no longer on Netflix now. But my pick, I just watched all 7 episodes, and this was based upon the novel Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which was, you know, if I were to describe it, it's kind of like Downton Abbey meets Harry Potter, perhaps. It takes place in the early 1800s, and it's about the trying to restore magic to England and the idea that there was magic 300 years prior, and then it went away when the Raven King left. And there's there's theoretical magicians who study what they can of the history of magic, but it's no longer there. But all of a sudden, there's magic coming back, and this is the middle of, you know, the Napoleonic Wars. So Britain obviously feels a need for that. This was by Suzanne Clark. I tried the book, it was like almost 800 pages, and it was too dry for me, but I really enjoyed the TV version of it, you know. So,
yeah, you know, I gave it 2 tries. I didn't finish the book. I didn't finish the audiobook. I just got lost in it. And there are certain people, you know, our friend Nate Staniforth, very talented magician, has read the book like 5 times. He just loves how rich and detailed, and he can sink his teeth into it. But it just didn't take with me. So I want to experience what he was talking about, and if the television show's the way to do it, then I'll take whatever I can get.
It's pretty amazing. The casting is fabulous. Having Mark Warren playing the gentleman is such an interesting casting. He's fey and scary all at the same time.
Yeah, it is a Eddie Marsan who's like on Ray Donovan, plays his brother, you know, who plays in that this Boston Southie kind of guy who's maybe not the brightest. Here he's playing this refined magician of the age who's got this extensive, he's an intellectual, and it's just to see him go between one character to play this, and wonderfully so. So yeah, exactly, so well casted. I enjoyed it very much. So that's my pick.
Right on.
I'm excited to see it, because like Andrew and Brian, I actually did get through the audiobook. Unfortunately, it was when Audible had you download multiple parts of it, and I accidentally started part 4 after stopping part 2, and I didn't realize that I had, because the book could be so jumpy in its time. And then eventually, I'm like, it feels like I missed a bunch of stuff, and I realized what I'd done, but I was like, oh, okay.
My parents, I was so excited, I gave them the 6 CDs to the audiobook for The Gunslinger, which is an odd story in that it has like a flashback within a flashback within a flashback. So it's very, very jumpy around. And they listened to all 6 discs. They loaded it in the caddy of their car the wrong way. So it just played the entire thing backwards. And they enjoyed it. And then they only at the end, when they put in the last disc, and it was like, The Gunslinger by Stephen King. Did they realize what they'd done?
That's funny.
Jody, thank you very much. We could find you, which Jody, how
JodyLinnye.com. 3 N's.
Okay, awesome. Awesome. So please, by all means, check that out. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been good fun.
So if you want to go to this Humble Bundle, go to bit.ly/HumbleScience, and it'll take you right to the Humble Bundle page, and you can take a look at all of the wonderful books. There are 22 books in 18 volumes, including a Orson Scott Card, Ender's Game story in one of the anthologies, and a lot of other things, including our guest here, Miss Jody Linnye. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.